evolution. That's probably the most difficult part of the whole talk, is the title. And one of those people that likes naming things, and I'd like to name a flower or a racehorse or something like that. I have a lot of internal divisions, and a lot of those internal divisions are going to come up in the topic of this talk. And one of the things that I have divisions about is the nature of reality. Sometimes everything seems very clear, and it seems as though reality is exactly what it appears to be and what we think it to be. Other times I think that our understanding of reality and our concept of it is okay for a beginning, but that it's very small, and that in perspective our understanding of reality isn't what it really is like at all. In fact, it's rather provincial. Now, at this point in the talks, especially relative to a frustrating subject like this, I sometimes feel that I have nothing left to say. Especially if you're dithering between opposites, it's very hard to have something definitive to say. And when you have nothing to say and you are speaking, what happens is you become desperate. And sometimes in desperation you look for almost anything to say. Especially you want to say things that don't offend people. So one resorts to things like politicians do. Politicians get desperate and they do positive things that everybody is going to like them for. Like they kiss babies. But even when we talk about babies, we have a lot of illusions. For instance, we think that babies are growing continuously. I think we have this illusion about babies because of the conception that we have, having even seen films in biology class about how mitosis works. And so we think it's a steady, ongoing process. Now, part of this illusion is because we aren't keenly aware of what's going on. We don't have the capacity to hold our attention on something long enough, and in those lapses, and even young parents have those kinds of lapses, things have changed, and we assume that the baby has been growing continuously. And it's the assumption that gets us into trouble, that causes illusion. And maybe even assumptions are illusions themselves. Max Heindel tells of a case where he had an illusion removed because of a desperate situation. He was working out of the body as an invisible helper, and he heard the equivalent of a scream. And he saw someone falling from a cliff. And what he did is he tried to materialize arms and an upper body to catch that person to break the fall. But the person was already dead before he got to the person. And what he noted was that when the person was falling, that behind the body there was a partial vacuum. And in that partial vacuum, the sustaining vital body, the etheric body, was sucked out into the vacuum and the person died. It's now generally known, not for the same reason by science, that in a great fall, a person dies before they hit the ground. They often think it's because of fear, but it's actually because of a partial vacuum. Max Heindel used this as the basis of doing some research, and he learned that the reason that people died on the battlefront from shells going over was not because of a shock wave from the shells, but because The shells passing over produced a vacuum, and in studying cases where people were taken out of the body, they were taken out of the body in that way. So all of the assumptions blocked the knowing of the truth. The fact is that babies don't grow steadily. Very patient research done with babies under cameras show that little infants grow in spurts. It's as though the body rests and prepares itself, and then suddenly it grows into a growth spurt, and it literally grows right before your eyes or before the camera. So lack of attention and the impedance of assumption can produce exactly the opposite illusion. Suppose yourself, you've been working on something for a really long time, and you're making very slow incremental process. And then a friend that has not been clearly attentive and has assumed that you're always the same, as friends tend to do, suddenly noticed. And they say, "When did you change so suddenly?" And of course, your inner feeling is, because you know all the work you've been doing, you want to say to yourself, you want to say to the person, "Where have you been?" And it's that kind of thing. Two different kinds of illusions can be born of the same, almost opposite illusions can be born off of the same faults. Now, we're being pretty intense and concentrated in these talks. And there's a danger in that. If you try to get too intense and concentrated on things, it's like trying to eat all of your protein for a week in one meal. You can do it, but it's usually not very good for your body to do that. Lions and snakes do it, but when they do that, you know what, I didn't start this thing. You're going to have to get a copy from you. Well, it's too many machines. Lions and snakes eat their entire food for quite a while, but when they do that, they have to digest and they have to rest for a long time. Now, when we do things so intensely like this, especially when we're focusing on specific social evolutionary or spiritual evolutionary problems, we might be subject to the illusion of the music from the late 19th and the 20th century, early 20th century, especially Romanticism. If you listen to Romantic music, you go from one mountaintop to another mountaintop with all kinds of deep valleys in between. There's just no peaceful, steady development of something. There's all kinds of emotional highs and all kinds of emotional lows, and you feel that when you've come out of listening to a piece of music, it's like you've been put through the washing machine, including the wringer. Minimalist music, like the music of Stephen Reich, is another matter. I used to hate it. And little by little, I'm beginning to like some aspects of it. It's very, very repetitive. It goes over the same thing again and again and again. And if you're not careful, you don't notice there's a sudden, subtle change. And that's the way the entire piece of music is like. Now, it may be that minimalist music is a reaction to Romanticism, saying, "Hey, don't go overboard and all of that. It's just too much excitement and not enough value." There are other values to minimalist music. Because if something is repetitive like that, you begin to understand a pace. Yes, there's a tempo in romantic music, but with all of the emotionalism of the ups and downs, the tempo isn't a really important matter. Now, minimalist music is in some ways like spiritual development. In spiritual development, we become, and we become very slowly. And since it deals with things eternal, it's dealing with the spiritual kind of consciousness that has to be applied continuously, and then the changes come very, very slowly. This is why a lot of people don't like true spiritual development. They like something with more excitement. They want the romanticism of a kind of spiritual development that boom, 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 things start happening. And they become impatient. Sometimes they get themselves into trouble and produce all kinds of horrible psychic conditions and things like that. But the big thing is that they miss what is behind this very slow development. You can sense the spirit as it is applying itself, which is more than your self-conscious awareness of it. You sense the spirit working in you, and it's a really wonderful thing to see progress come and come slowly in such a way that one can be aware of it. Now, in paces, or in gates, or in relative speeds, there are also things that are apparencies. Some of them seem illusory. We talked about one in the past when we said, if you look at a spoked wheel, if it's going slowly enough, you can see the spokes move forward. If it's going a little bit faster, it seems, because of the way the eye works, it seems as though the spokes in the wheel are going backward because the nerves can only react so quickly. And if it's going at a faster rate yet, the wheel seems solid. Those are all appearances or things that are apparent but not necessarily real. If we get the right perspective, we see a different phase of reality. And that's an example from perception. That is what we're trying to get at least at this point. We're talking about getting at valid perception, perspectives of things at different rates of growth. Now, some people are very quick. Very valuable, and they get the concept of evolution almost instantaneously. But those same people have trouble accomplishing things often because they don't understand the reality of waking up the spirit and all the many facets of the spirit that are there. And to them, it is as painful and as tedious as listening to minimalist music. We hear this a lot. We hear people say that things never change and human beings are as bad as they've ever been. Usually it focuses on the negative and not as on the good. Other people can't keep up with the pace of evolution, and changes happen too quickly for them. And the pace of it all is unbearable. And they react. And in their reaction, they try to go back. And they try to go back to a past that never was, when things were done the way they were supposed to be done. Their idealism is in the past. It's not in the future. It's not like we're working towards some ideal. It's like we're degenerating away from the ideal. There is a pace. Or there are paces to evolution. And at the same time, there are many ways that things can be done. And there are many ways to live at a pace that is appropriate for the range and scope of the part of evolution that you're working with. And when you are in your pace relative to evolution, there's a feeling that goes along with it. And it has to do with a very common statement. God is in its heaven and all is well. Because even if things are hectic and very fast changing and everything seems like chaos, if you are on a pace, if you are in touch with the Spirit in yourself, God is in its heaven and all is well. Now, by now, you've probably noted that the pace and the scope of this talk are also very small and very slow, and to the point that it's almost tedious as far as things are developing. And that's by intention. And I try to do, for several reasons, I try to do things like that. When I'm giving a talk, and there is a principle in the talk, I try to live in that principle and have the talk be like what the principle is about, instead of being a commentator from without and not participating in that principle, I try to actually live in it. That's, of course, patting myself on the back too much. But another reason why this is slow and tedious is because we are in transition. We are in transition to something new. And when we transit into something new, progress is always slow before we start climbing rapidly on what is called the learning curve, I think is what it is. In the first three talks in this series, we looked into the long-range time of the processional cycle and saw the Aquarian age relative to cycles that were 25,000 years long. We even mentioned longer cycles than that. We also tried to get a sense of what historical process was like, and we tried to get a big picture of what it was all like. Then we transited through 11 talks on relating each of the other signs of the zodiac to Aquarius. Some we looked at twice relative to Aquarius. One sign we did not go into, and we'll do that very late in the talks when it is more appropriate. Now we are trying to relate to Aquarius itself. And so for the next several talks, we're going to talk about principles that are Aquarian, and after that we'll try to put everything all together and unify it, and then we'll try to localize it to our time and our work in our time. Basically, you might say that we're enjoying ourselves. Christ said that my joy may be full in you. And our enjoyment is that we are playing with principles. And hopefully we're doing it like little babies or little children. We're toying with things. Little babies, when they come into the world, they come in as clean as humans can be at this stage of evolution. The Rosicrucian philosophy, we're told that they come straight from heaven and that they're little bundles of love that people just can't help but to love them. And as they are little children, they still have a lot of that clarity and that innocence and that purity, and they have a fresh look at things so that they see things that jaded adults do not see. And so we have the passage from biblical Christ, unless ye come as little children, you cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. Meaning to say, we have to have that kind of attitude. But when they come, they are also infantile in their worldly development. They don't know about this world. A little child tries to reach for something that's in the other side of the room, and it can't walk, it can't talk, it can't really express itself in this world at all. So they become educated. And in the process of education, we all want to educate our children well. We educate them into the assumptions that we recognize reality as being. What we think is real is what we teach them. And it's good because we learn a lot about reality, but sometimes all of us as humanity are fooled about the way things really are, and then along comes a fresh discovery and we see things altogether differently. And so it turns out that we indoctrinate children as much as we educate them. And the more educated someone is, the more indoctrinated they are. I worked with people who were very highly educated, but they were indoctrinated into a worldview because what they did was scientifically logical, that they could not see the world in any other way than the way they saw it. And it seemed to be obvious that for many of them it was an inhibition and it was a restraining of their appreciation of reality. Oh, I'm way lost away from my notes here. Now, it's not that the things that we educate people into that they are bad, and that old things are bad, because they're usable. They work. And it's just a matter that the future wants new things, not just for the sake of newness, but there are progressions. There are progressions into that wonderfully great unknown, the future. Now, not all of the things that are new are good. But they are new with that infantile freshness. Almost unconsciously, except to creative youth and rebellious youth, where people still have the idealism of teenage years and some of the innocence of children, most people, when they are adults, do not recognize that they come under the tyranny of the past. Some people base their whole lives on the tyranny of the past. It's called precedence, a system of precedence. And most people don't know what's happening to them because the people that are indoctrinating are people that they love. Little kindergartners love their children. You love your minister, you love your parents, and the parents really believe they're doing something right, and they're doing the best that they can. So my mother told me, she said, I didn't know what I was doing was right. She said, you don't know those things. You don't know what's best. But she said, you do the best you can. And I thought that was exceedingly honest of her. Culturally, we have legal precedents. We have traditions, we have conventions, we have grandfather clauses and all of those kinds of things, and they all result in crystallization, in cultural and psychological accretion. Now, in geology, because there are new outcroppings, doesn't mean the old ones have gone away. The old ones hang on for a long, long time before they're gradually worn away. Now, the process that we're talking about is more than that, because it isn't just a matter of like changing automobiles or changing appliances or something like that. The old ones don't work as well as the new ones, and you do something completely new. Because there is more life and there is more dynamism to the whole process, things metamorphize such that scales become feathers and gill sacs or the sacs become lungs and feet become flippers in some cases. So it's a process that involves metamorphosis. And the process is certainly much more than just physical. The physical body, as a vehicle, keeps growing, and it keeps getting better with regard to the environment, and so there's more perfection. Objective character keeps developing in quality. It keeps developing in spiritual content. So it is an ongoing process. Now, in whether we're talking about the evolution of form or whether we're talking about the evolution of character and consciousness, there are some sub-cycles. And they follow the same process as the general evolution. For example, a person in one rebirth may think bad thoughts and become so habituated to them so that when they're thinking out the form for their next life, the bad thoughts sink into the desire nature and they then have bad emotions, bad feelings. And eventually you act on your feelings, so maybe in a third life, a person has bad actions. They harm other people or they try to darken other people or something of that nature. And then finally, everything gets worked right into the physical and then you have something like a disease. Following the same process that the general grand evolution follows, it this is a sub-process that goes on. It doesn't always follow that exact path because different people have different ways of bringing things about, but it's a natural cosmological principle. Eventually, the experience, you can't doubt it if you're ill. You can't doubt it if your body doesn't function. Suppose you're paralyzed, you have nothing, there's no doubt about the fact that something that you've done has resulted in this. Of course, you may not consciously recognize it, but the spirit within knows. And when the spirit within has taken something as far as it goes and the consequence is malfunction or no function at all, the spirit wakes up to that. And it is through these kinds of sub-processes, as well as a big process altogether, that we grow and we improve. It's a slow way, but we improve. We can see it in a faster way. If you learn a musical instrument, you try to play a song, and as you're playing that song, you make mistakes. But you keep practicing, and eventually you don't make those mistakes anymore, and finally you get it down perfectly. Said in the Bible that angels ascend and descend on the Son of Man. So these kinds of sub-cycles work both up and down in us. For example, if we do good deeds, those good deeds become soul material in our etheric body in the next life, and we have greater light. We are in light, more enlightened, illumined beings. But those things descend back into the ethers because we then can build a stronger etheric body for fulfilling the purposes of the etheric body. So things go up and down between the lower and higher ethers, and generally the whole etheric body increases. It becomes more perfect, it becomes more effective. So a lot of things of the past are not bad things. They are reinvented. I have a friend who is a reinventor. He's almost unknown in the Western world, even though they did a magazine article in Discover Magazine about 15 years ago of him. He's a reinventor. he has partners with whom he takes an invention. I got him a bunch of bicycle pumps, tire pumps, and by reversing the valves on them, he turned them into vacuum pumps. And then what he does is he gives them to people who want them in third world countries. And if nomadic people move from place to place, they want seeds that don't go bad. And so just using something like a Coke bottle or a food bottle, you can by using a really simple way, you can produce a vacuum and you can vacuum seal those seeds, and the seeds remain viable for years rather than having to be planted within 1 or 2 years. And what he does is take something old and reinvents it in another way, and then he gives it to his partner, and his partner improves on the invention and gives it back to him. And it's almost like a competition in cooperation until they have produced an invention, you know, like using automobile jacks. They have made very efficient oil presses so that people in third world countries have oil presses without having to spend all kinds of money. Some of the same things happen in negative, because sometimes when changes come, there's a struggle over them. Some of those reactionaries don't want to change. Some of those futurists are wide-eyed fanatics, bomb throwers. So sometimes to change, there is a war or a revolution. But in general, what we see is our lives, our experience, and even our vehicles of consciousness are an aggregate perfection from past experiences. They are a cumulative effect of all kinds of evolutionary experience. There are problems with the cumulative part of this process. And it seems that what we need to do is to know how to deal with some of these problems. Because if we are to transition into the Aquarian Age, where things are going to be very new and very different, and we're going to have a shockingly different kind of conscious experience compared to what we have now, we had better cleanse ourselves or purge ourselves of some of the problems of cumulative evolution so we don't transplant them into another world and have problems therein. Now, these problems from cumulative experience are sort of like a cluster of things. They're a cluster of psychological problems and spiritual attitude problems. Some of the problems psychologically are inertia. It's just so much easier to keep going on the way we're going on. And you can add to that an attitude of phlegmatism, of contentment. And for some people, if they don't like the rate of change, it becomes, as we said before, fundamentalism. Now, there are corollary problems to some of these, in that when we're dealing with the present, we're dealing with fact. And we have a lot of respect for fact. But sometimes we're inflexible and we are prejudiced about fact. Facts are facts, but what they mean or how they are interpreted or how they are used is what the problem is. See, when we live in this kind of world, we're looking at facts all the time. And we are, in a way, preoccupied. And that preoccupation is a distraction from really understanding things in another way. Now, problems, like new things, are problems of this kind, we hang on to things in such a way that we don't want to look for something new or accept something new or even try out something new because there's no verification. And we want and we need verification. Now, it's an interesting matter because the form of things changes, but the internal reality is constant. There is that famous myth of Proteus that is famous for what young clairvoyants are taught. Young clairvoyants are taught that when they see a form, they have to distinguish between the form and the internal reality. And you do that by concentrating and never letting go. And what happens is that who is the hero that catches Proteus, the river god, and he grabs onto him? He has to swim under the water and then come up in a grotto, and then he grabs a hold of Proteus. And Proteus turns into all kinds of different things, into animals and like snakes and even into fire and into all kinds of the monstrous things until Proteus realizes that this is somebody that's not going to let go, and then he shows himself as he really is. And that's what we're trying to get at. Now, in the past, we have stated that if we are subjective, especially if we are sentimentally subjective about the past, we are like the fundamentalists. Our memory will play tricks on us, and that the only way that we can really deal with the past is objectively. Facts are facts, and things are as they are. On the other hand, to apply objectivity to the future is what we're talking about right now, the danger of that, the danger of seeing the future in terms of the cumulative experience from the past. And if we do that, we can be successful, but we will have a spiritual materialism. And if we do that, we will see only what we have built ourselves to see, objectifying from the past, rather than experiencing something new. We have to learn then, in one way or another, to let go, and to let go in such a way that we realize that we are who we are, and that it isn't going to be taken away from us if the cultural factors that have led us in our personality to be what we are, that what our true spiritual nature is not going to be taken away from us if we let go. So now let's look again at subjectivity and objectivity as we have before, but in another way. And let's try to combine this with new things. Let's try to relook at time and at history, because we're talking about evolutionary process. Subjectivity tends to be more microcosmic, and it tends to be personal. And we don't mean something derogatory. We have to be subjective beings. We can see this subjectivity if we're playing a game of bridge, or if we're playing a game of chess, and we don't see some things just because we are too much wrapped up in the subjectivity. This is even if we don't have an ego thing about whether we win or lose. We're still wrapped up in our subjectivity. The great chess players or the great bridge players are the ones that don't have any ego at stake, and they can take their consciousness and they can look at things objectively as though they were outside of them. The kibitzers often see things that the people playing don't see because they're on the objective outside. Objectivity tends to be macrocosmic. And it tends to be impersonal, which is not meant to be flattering. It's just another kind of fact. It's not even meant to be in the derogatory sense of impersonal. If we're in the grandstand, or if we're looking at that nice squared screen of the television, we can see things that the quarterback can't see, because we have the grander view, and we can look impersonally at the matter. Often we don't care as much. You can see when subjectivity enters into the grandstand view. I used to go to a lot of basketball games. You can tell who the fans are. The fans are the ones that don't see whether a call is right. When it's close, they all see it in favor of their team. So, if we look at the present as issuing from the past with a subjective, microcosmic, personal attitude, we're likely to experience it in terms of personal things, successes and accomplishments, or persecutions or failures or something like that, instead of objectively as it really is. This happens all the time. We're way too subjective about the nature of the present for us. Suppose we're on the high side of a cycle, and things are going our way, and it seems as though we can do no wrong, we subjectively say to ourselves, this is because I deserve it, cause and consequence. And we get we add those unnecessary things to it so that we are vain about it, and without realizing that in so doing, we have failed the test of success. And in those extraneous kinds of thoughts and attitudes, we're planting the seeds so that when the cycle turns down and we're in the low stage of the cycle, we're going to have a low stage all over again. This, I believe, is what has happened in the United States. When you get to the top, you tend to become self-satisfied. And getting to the top for the United States was World War II. Everything before World War II was, we always rooted for the underdog. Now we root for number one. You see that finger up there all the time. We're number one. And before World War II, we had a work ethic. Now we have an ethic of consumerism, or enjoying ourselves to excess in entertainment. So we've had success, but we have not been self-conscious in that success, so that we have contained ourselves, and we're setting ourselves up for a difficult down cycle when that comes. So we tend to look at the present in terms of honors or resentments, and we look at success in terms of vindication, instead of just going through the experience, appreciating the experience for what it is, and cleanly growing from it. Now, this subject of these things happening to us cumulatively is not easy to see this happening. At one time, I used to live among artists. And there was a painter who was a most unusual man. He was both a painter and a sculptor, and he was magnificent. But he did something very unusual. When he was a young man, he went to France. And he went to France, and he didn't become an artist. He became a graphic artist, like working for print companies and things like that. And when he made enough money, he came back to the United States and became a fine artist all on his own. And I think he's probably the greatest artist I've known. And I was also hanging out at that same time with a musician who was totally informal all together. And there used to be battles between the two of them. And eventually the musician turned out to be right, because the painter or sculptor kept having more and more pieces of his work around him, and he didn't realize it, but the sense of satisfaction at having created all of these things damped his creative impulse. And so he kept on finishing works of art when they didn't need to be finished any further. But the reason he kept on going is because he didn't have enough creativity going forward. On the other hand, the musician regularly had a ceremony where he would burn all of his compositions, and he kept his life open. I think that's a little bit extreme, but I think you realize what I'm talking about. That there has to be, for a healthy state of being in a human being, whether it's an artist or ordinary people like you and I, there has to be a healthy coordination between memory and creativity. If we have misapplications, that's when we produce all kinds of prejudices and exaggerated things. What happens is, as we get older, we have more and more memories. And if we haven't taken care to cultivate our creativity and dissolve our memories into their essence, what happens is we eventually regress and we live in a childlike way in our memories, and we are overwhelmed by them. We go into a regressive second childhood. On the other hand, if we cultivate creativity, we keep on growing. We have that kind of balance. So what we're talking about is the creative fire versus the solidification of a crude memory or other cumulative things in us. So that means we have to do something cultural, which we don't often do in these talks, and we're going to read this entire book of poetry. No, one only, and a very short one at that. Fire and ice. Some say the world will end in fire. Some say in ice. From what I've tasted of desire, I hold with those who favor fire. But if it had to perish twice, I think I know enough of hate to say that for destruction, ice is also great and would suffice. Robert Frost. And so we're talking about fire and ice. We don't want to get too highfalutin. So in order to get not too highfalutin, we have to talk about fire and ice in a different way. I used to ride my bicycle to work every day, even through the snow. But sometimes when it got really, really bad, I would walk. And one day it got so bad, it was raining ice, that for every step that I took forward, I slid back too. So I turned around, went home, and got to work in record time. It's something like they say in the Burlington Liars Club, so let's talk a little bit about slipping into the future in that more subtle way rather than burning our way into the future creatively. Now, earlier, it seems almost like hours ago, we took a look at brief illusions in time by looking at infantile growth spurts. Now let's spiral back into that topic, but let's look at it with a larger scope. In Western mysticism, we are told that periods of manifest activity alternate with periods of rest. And we are told
that there is activity in the periods of rest, but it's of a different kind. And that the periods of rest are equal to the periods of, relatively, to the periods of manifestation. Now, I'm going to just state something to produce an idea, and I'm not trying to be mensurally accurate in this. This isn't meant to be exactly as it is, just something to get a point through. And we'll give an arbitrary assignment. Now suppose between the great manifestations and the rests between manifestations, we spend half the time at rest. Then the manifestations are broken into half the time in a period of manifestation and half the time in a period of rest. So this turns out that over all universal time, this is, you know, all kinds of assumptions in here, don't jump down my throat, that if we started out with half the time, half the time in manifestation, and then half of the half of the time in manifestation in periods is spent in rest, and then there are revolutions in each period of time, and half of the time then is spent in rest, and on each globe, passing between globes, there is another half of the time in rest, and you keep on going with this series, and what you end up is that relative to all universal time, you have 63/64 approximately of time in rest. Now that's quite a phenomenal thing. That's a really big thing. Now, yes, there are periods, you know, like it comes all the way down. Half of the time is day, and half of the time is night, and half of the time is winter when things are dormant. You know, it isn't exact as we see the world right now, but you get the whole idea. And we are active at night when we're asleep. If we're out of the body, we can work as invisible helpers. But it's not the same thing as when we're here, because the manifest finalization of things here in this end of the line, the proving ground, is where real progress is made. And yes, the rest of cosmic nights isn't as deep as the rest between manifestations, but nonetheless, the whole idea is that we spend an enormous amount of time in rest. This is a big cop-off for the fact that I like to sleep, unfortunately. Unfortunately, these days, I can't sleep like I used to. So what we're talking about in terms of getting things done where they are finalized, which happens right now in the dense physical world, the pace is very slow. It's not like the pace of a horse race, or of us trying to race through these talks. It's a pace that's much more like a game of chess, which might take several days, or like the pace of cutting a diamond. There's all kinds of thought and imagination and reobserving of things. Now, we're here to make hay while the sun shines. That means that here in the physical world is what it is ripe for us right now. But we, in doing the things that we do in and with and about the physical world as our creation and as our gift to the beings that are evolving in the material world, isn't all. It tells us that if we want to adjust our lives to be copacetic or analogous to the grand cosmos, because because we are the microcosmic image of the cosmos, and it is in us that an enormous amount of time of cleansing, of pondering, of resting, and all of those activities that take place in the dormant period. This is why, in terms of general evolution, and especially right now where we tend to get bogged down by cumulative things, why an exercise like retrospection is so important. In retrospection, we see our lives backwards, and we see them from the opposite perspective. We see them from the outside in, the objective perspective, rather than from the inside out. And we try to re-feel the feelings of the things that we have felt. And thereby we neutralize experiences, and the essence of those experiences gets built into our higher vehicles and into our spiritual being, and it is readily available to us right now. So what we're talking about is how important it is to free ourselves from unwholesome connection to the material world, and how the rest, or you might say the concentrated rest of something like retrospection, how important it is to our evolutionary career. It is a fact that as evolution proceeds, we are going to spend a lot of time looking back, like old people look back, and in that looking back, we're actually even going to dissolve the different worlds in reverse order and to extract the essence of all of the experience. This is something of the future. And it isn't just the cleansing, because at the same time that we absorb and assimilate all of the results of the experience, when they are taken into the spirit is activated and the creativity is increased. So in the first half of the creation, we were creatures. We were worked on. But the more that we cleanse ourselves and the more that we take the facts of our past into us, the more we become divine creative beings. This is why, more even than diamond cutters, why great spiritual beings like those that founded the Rosicrucian Order, the ones that are adepti for many lives past, why they take centuries to ponder out a spiritual movement so that it can be successful and so that it can help things. There's another reason for all of this. If we are really pondering, and if we are really planning, and we're trying to do something creatively beautiful, it's much more efficient to do it in our consciousness than it is in the physical world. We only get so much time here. And if we make a mistake and we have to correct the mistake, it always takes a lot more time to correct the mistake than if we had done it right in the first place. And there is, you know, it's a very wise thing that in our consciousness we become in control of things, that we have a forethought. I think any of you that has ever participated in any kind of creative experience, if you've ever written a tune, or if you've ever written a poem or something like that, it takes a long time to write a piece of music. And then you perform it, zingo, it's done, just like that. In just a few minutes, something that took hours and hours to create is over. And that's a analogous microcosm of the way things work in the world. This is why we take failures so seriously, because in a way we are all aesthetes. We all recognize that we have goofed up something that is very beautiful for everyone. All right, let's take a look once more at the relationship of rest and cleansing to cumulative evolution, and let's just look at it in terms of very few evolutionary facts. We are between the state of being creatures and creators. We have a foot in both worlds. And in that passing from creatures to creators, we're making a long, slow leap of faith until we see it all for ourselves, to where we balance internal values with external values. We are becoming inward in compensation in our waking consciousness to the external. We are somewhat perversely attached to the externals of things, because some see rest or silence or something like that, they see it as an absence, and they want to fill it up as quickly as they can. It's a fact that in terms of evolution, if we move more slowly than the pace of evolution, we fall behind. There is no standing still in evolution. Either we're going forward or we're going backward. And if we're going forward too slowly, we're going relatively backward. So personal attachment to things of the world, to ourselves in relation to them, slows down our progress. This is why, again, all the cleansing and rest and just sitting by yourself and doing nothing. You think about things, and you think about what you have and haven't done. And when you do that, it is amazingly good for your creative consciousness, for your evolutionary consciousness. Now, in terms of the Aquarian Age, in terms of time, we stand relative to the beginning of the Aquarian Age to where Augustus Caesar, stood relative to the beginning of the Age of Pisces. And that means when something new is coming, and if we don't accept, and if we don't anticipate and welcome and give ourselves to something new, we are in danger of regressing in memories. And by the time of Augustus Caesar, most of the early Roman religion was pretty much dead. And the people needing something and not accepting what was coming from Christianity, because it was of the Pisces age and it had all kinds of piety and it didn't have all the pride that the Aries people of Greece and Rome had, to take humility and to take a position where you're not important. That was offensive to them, and they couldn't accept the new, so they reverted back to Mandeanism and a lot of other ancient religions, and as a consequence, that went along with the disintegration of the society and the self-denigration of the people in that society. So we're in that same position. And we have the same kind of temptation. In fact, we're even in a bigger position, because we are anticipating not only a change into the Aquarian Age, but before too long, maybe just several millennia, maybe even less, maybe more, we're anticipating going back into the ethers with the dissolution of the physical earth, where we live in energy. And you can see what I'm trying to get at. If we are hanging on to the physical body and to physical things, and that is what is true to us, and that is what is most important to us, we're in a tough place. We aren't going to accept the new. There are all kinds of tendencies right now to go back to earlier forms of religion and spirituality. There's nothing wrong with those earlier forms of religion and spirituality. It's just that they're not timely. They are not appropriate for our evolution. Most of them were before there was a scientific method. And it's really strange, you see the contortions that people put themselves into. And I don't mean, I don't, that is not a pun on yoga. The contortions that they put themselves into to have scientific doubt and at the same time try to accept things in a passive way from a very ancient kind of religion. Even if we return to the ethers in the new world, there's a danger in that. Even if we accept it or partially accept it, it's possible that we may transplant the attitudes that we have for materialism. Boy, I skipped a whole bunch of information here. It's really important. Well, we're not suggesting faddism, and we're not suggesting accepting something new just because it's something new. Young people don't want to hear about the good old days because they are the people that want to do what's happening right now. Old people don't understand that. It's not that young people are incapable of that, it's just that they want something new. So it's time for another joke. That's a joke that I'm sure every one of you has heard before, but it's worth telling again. I'll tell it with an ethnic background, but I do not have anything against the ethnic group. It's a Sven and Ole joke. And Sven and Ole are out fishing, and all of the cosmos conspires in their favor, and they're at bag limit in no time flat. They've got all of the fish that they can get. And Sven says to Ole, maybe we should remember this place so that we can come back tomorrow. He says, why don't we put a mark on the side of the boat so that we can come back here tomorrow? And Ole says, wait a minute, Sven. How do we know we're going to get the same boat tomorrow? If you stop and think about the joke, there's a reason that it's witty. It's witty because there's much more to it than first meets the eye. We're talking about people who are planning to go back to a space to a space-time condition that will have been passed. And that's the absurd thing. We can't go back to what was before. It's utterly impossible. The other fellow realizes that it won't work, but for the wrong reason. Because he's focusing on boats in time, which is a vehicle of experience in time, rather than positioning oneself in time-space. And not in the vehicles. So we know what we know. But we identify with how we came to that knowledge. And it is often more of an impediment than a help to be identified with knowledge and how we came to that knowledge rather than what can be derived from it. I had an experience when I was a very young man. I had a mystical experience, and after that mystical experience, I learned creative thinking. And in that creative thinking, I would discover things. And one day, I was working in a print shop, and I was cutting some paper, and in my consciousness, I was thinking about population, and population relative to obliquity of the orbit and why more people would have to be born under such and such time. And I made a discovery about rebirth relative to astrological or astronomical geometry. And it was wonderful. And then I had another understanding, because this is a subject that I had been thinking on for a number of times. I realized that I could have made this discovery before, but because I had not followed my earlier thinking along, I couldn't make the next step of discovery. And the reason I couldn't do that is because I was indulging myself in the feeling of discovery in the preceding part of it. And then when I discovered about discovering, I had a realization that the feeling of discovery and knowing something is, it was such that this is what I had been seeking in other things all of my life, such as in sex. Unfortunately, the same thing happened. I got excited, and I guess I indulged myself in excitement. That sounds like an unusual combination of words, but it's a true one. And that kept me from understanding that whole matter more in its cause. And because of that, I've had years and years of grief from mistakes made on the line. By concentrating on knowledge and on our knowing, and sometimes even the process of knowing, we are not thinking about the unknown and the rejuvenative effect of the unknown, because there is a spiritual rejuvenation that runs parallel to the physical rejuvenation that happens in sleep. We're back to rest again. It's through knowledge that we come to light, but knowledge is a product of light. And the light is what we want and not the product. If you think about it, the atmosphere that we're living in now, every bit of it is light or condensation of light. Not live light, but dead light. It's been deadened so that we can understand it. It's like we can't eat live things in our mind or in our spiritual consciousness. We have to have dead things. That's one of the problems of the fall of humanity. So, what exists is what we tend to think of reality as being. But when we think of only the material and the manifest part rather than the unmanifest part. There are examples that show it perfectly well. If we take a chord of music, the chord of music has its value in the notes, but the relationship of the notes that gives them meaning is in the interval and in the spaces between the notes, so it isn't a continuous drone, is where the meaning comes. In both cases, it is in that seemingly empty nothingness. It goes even further than that, that some of the most powerful parts of music are rests. When you're not just being lilted along by following a melody or chord changes or something like that, the truth that is born in the melody suddenly is shown in the rest by itself without the distraction of a vehicle. The music is meant to be a springboard to that kind of truth. The problem is that we often pride ourselves in knowledge of things and not the source of that knowledge or the meaning of that knowledge, which is in non-things. I'm not trying to say that we should all become nihilists and follow Schopenhauer or something like that, but I am saying that there needs to be a just relationship between what is present and what exists in spiritual rest. The unknown or the future is clean. It's clean like a baby is clean. And it's clean like we feel after we've had sleep. It's more of our friend than knowledge. Knowledge has a kind of a false security. It was with great wisdom that the disciples in the Bible were told, don't worry about what you're going to say. Wait until the moment, and it comes there. And it's never failed me. I've been in all kinds of positions, and spontaneity was always there for me, as long as I didn't bottle myself up within my own personality. So as long as we give ourselves to the unseen God, as St. Paul calls it, we are giving ourselves to the ultimate mystery. That keeps things alive. Now, just for a very few minutes, let's try and relate this more directly to the Aquarian Age and what we're going through now. We're now in the last throes of Piscean Christianity, and that's a very fine religion for those who need it, but we're looking for something new. We're looking for something more fulfilling. And one does not pour new wine into old bottles. And we're obviously in need of something that is much more volatile than wine. And so we're talking about those kinds of experiences. This is almost over. It's not too much more tedium. So the central theme that we've been speaking about all evening is the waxing importance of rest and dissolution of the known so that it can become fertilizer for greater consciousness. We've seen that memory fosters and even focuses innovation if there is a proper balance. The whole idea is to have a balance between knowledge and creativity. Where there is not too much memory, there is much more creativity. Babylonian mathematics was different from Greek mathematics. They didn't write all of the, had this grand pyramid of this proves this, proves this, proves this. In mathematics now, it's become impossibly complex when they have like 60 pages of calculations and they have people that are connecting together all of the things in mathematics. You can't know all the mathematics anymore. It's that big. Babylonians would remember one thing and they would re-improvise and rediscover every time they needed something. And as a consequence, their mathematics flourished, but it was in the Babylonian way and it never got to get all of the press that Greek mathematics did. Improvisational jazz is that way. As long as you have a balance between what you know and what you create, you progress. You have an ongoing creative life. It is an ongoing thing with regard to life. As we go older, we rely on our memories. When we do so, our creativity diminishes. In fact, the height of creativity in most fields, except for philosophy and one or two other things, is at age 24, between age 24 and 25. And the more we live in memory, the more we go back, and the more we regress. And so what we're trying to do now is look at that side of the problem, the side of cumulative accretion in consciousness and both our psychology and in our spiritual understanding of things. Because it has a large part to do of what we'll be doing in the future. Everything will be taken into the spiritual worlds. Living philosophies, which is what we're trying to do, we're trying to go along with the process of spiritual evolution. This is why we study spiritual evolution. It's not just a matter of erudition and to be able to say that this is a result of this period back then or something like that. It is something that we can put ourselves in touch with what's ripe now and what's going to become ripe so that we can help the whole process along. We're looking for a living philosophy, and in that living philosophy, we want to be evolutionary. And for us to be evolutionary, that means to be self-reliant. To be self-reliant means to rely on the creative spirit inside of ourselves in order to be epigenesis. At one time in life, I thought I was going to be a writer. Never happened. And I subscribed to a magazine called Publish. It was really interesting, and they took themselves seriously. And every few months, they completely changed the format of the magazine because they had to live true to what they were trying to espouse. Like in your publication or in your creation, in your writing, you want to do new. You want to be going forward. All right, if we don't get snagged in the form of the Pisces age so that we distort when we come into the Aquarian age, we can help the whole process to go forward. Now, in our quarantine in material blindness, which has been probably at its darkest in the age of Pisces, we have become personally identified with our bodies. We have come through a kind of individuation through this personal individualism, but it is an individualism that is extremely self-partisan. It is subjective. It is very relativistic. So if we do not dissolve this and we carry this into the Aquarian age, The Aquarius has this floaty kind of consciousness, and we can even see the roots of this happening already. The egoism associated with individualism is seen as doing your thing. And there are psychologies, such as Gestaltism, that say, hey, you do your thing and I do my thing and everything is fine and dandy. That's one of the dangers. Now, I'm not trying to condemn Gestaltism or anything like that, but that kind of thinking is one of the dangers. What we really want to do is we want to dissolve the identification on ourselves personally. And if we identify with anything, we want to identify with the spirit that is universal. That is what all of us have in common, which is where altruism is to be found. And so what we're looking for then is an altruism where we love each other just as, instead of just sort of saying, hey, your thing is all right, just don't bug me with mine. Now, Pisces has been the time of blind concepts, including the superstitions of science. Now, I'm not saying that all science is superstition, but a lot of the basis of it is that. Like I just heard a physicist last night say everything is based on physics. And that's the basis of everything else. And I just wanted to scream at the radio, no, it isn't. A body at rest tends to stay at rest until there's something that moves it. And that for physics, that's something without. And everything according to physics, we should never be able to get up out of our chairs and move. And, you know, because we're the spiritual beings that do that. So what happened is that we developed these superstitions. What the danger is that we may take this same paradigm and put it on a different experience that is the more etheric experience of the spiritual worlds that comes with Aquarius. And we find a lot of that already. It is a form of spiritual materialism. Everything is tried to be, the basis of all truth is matter, which is really strange because Deeply spiritual groups, like the Platonists, for example, believe that matter is the basis of all lies, which is a little bit extreme, but they associated with, so they associated in that way. Another thing, going to the opposite extreme, more from the first half of the age of Pisces, we had the I am a worm in the dirt kind of Christianity. It was extreme. It is that we abased ourselves and we put ourselves in a very bad place. And this does not, the human spirit will not allow for this. So when we pass from a polarized negative sign like Pisces to a polarized positive sign like Aquarius, the last time that we were in a polarized positive sign was in the age of Aries. And we had an enormous hubris. And that was even without compensating for the kind of self-abasement and false humility that we've had in the Pisces age, so that we have to be extremely careful about being reactionary in the Aquarian way, like I know this and I know that, and that we have this pride in intellectual ability and attainment, which is bound to be a terrible downfall for us. What is more important is, again, that we find the poise of individuality in such a way that we accept others as equals, and if we accept ourselves as equals with others, it's like with friends. Who's the better one of us in the friendship? That just doesn't work. If you try to think that way, it doesn't work. And so rather than pride, if we it is perfectly possible for us to have a just appreciation of ourselves relative to other people in the spirit of altruism. Pisces has been a time of slavery and of blindness, and especially to the illusions of secrecy. The reaction to this is likely to be licentiousness. In the Aquarian age, there is a great possibility of licentious behavior. If you think you owe yourself something, no matter how much you have been enslaved to something saying no to you, you're going to give it to yourself. This would be like a very broad-based licentiousness. The true attitude toward Pisces, if we again free ourselves, if we free ourselves from our indulgences and all of the tendencies that we have in that direction, again by rest and by cleansing, the consequence is freedom. Not being a slave to anything, not personal desires, not sensations of the physical world, not even our thoughts. We are the free beings that do the thinking. Now, I have one little one here I guess I could go with. I don't like doing list-like things like this. I would just as soon have a listless life, pun intended in that case. In the Pisces age, we've been monastic, and we've been escapist from our problems. We put them in institutions of one kind or another. In the age of Aquarius, there's a danger of being communal, having too separative of communities. What we, of course, need is universal consciousness. Aquarius is extremely universal, very broad-based. All right, I don't want to continue going on with these lists. All I want to say is that in this, we have a leader in Christ leading us into the Aquarian age, and we were told very clearly that if we wish to follow that route, we have to give up father and mother, and we have to sell all of our possessions so that in reality, in our inner being, we are attached to none of them. And we are told that we are to be friends, completely friends with everyone. In short, what Christ was saying is what we've been trying to say all night, is we have to let go of attachment of any kind. And then we can hear what we hear at the very end in the book of Revelation, "Behold, I make all things new." Somebody tell a Sven and Ole joke.